Starting your own private medical practice can be the most exciting and rewarding thing you'll ever do in your career, but at the same time, it can be so daunting. Where do you start and how? That's why Gentem Health put together the podcast series, Journey to Private Practice, where we document and interview entrepreneurs, clinicians, investors, and the best in the industry to bring you actionable insights as how to start, grow, and scale your private practice. With insights tailored just for you, and actionable links in the notes, this is the Journey to Private Practice. Hey, podcast listeners, this is your host, Omar M. Khatib, with another great episode of Journey to Private Practice. This time, we have a great guest. We have wonderful guests, of course, all of them great. But today's guest, you probably know him from the popular podcast, Physician's Guide to Doctoring, which in my opinion, that podcast has hands down the best tagline ever, which is this podcast answers the question, what should we have been learning while we were memorizing Krebs cycle? Man, did I take you guys back to med school? I know that line definitely took me back to the good old days of MS1, MS2. So Dr. Block is a practicing ENT who's part of a very large group up in the New York region. And he's part of a committee called the Patient Experience Committee. So we've heard about UX, which is user experience. You can call this PX, patient experience. And so there is a strategy and process to optimizing the patient experience between the doctor and the staff. And more importantly, how do you use that experience, those processes, to not only maximize patient satisfaction, but more importantly, maximize the success the patients will have when it comes to their treatment. So we dive into this extremely interesting topic and answer a lot of interesting questions that come along with it, as well as Dr. Block's fantastic backstory and, of course, his humor. So without further ado, here's our episode with Dr. Bradley Block. Hey, podcast listeners, this is Omar M. Khatib, your host for Journey to Private Practice. My guest tonight, good friend, somebody who I was lucky to meet through the interwebs, specifically the physician podcasting interwebs. That's Dr. Brad Block. Dr. Block, how you doing?
Great, great. Please, Brad.
Brad. All right, Brad. Great to meet you. Thanks for coming on the show. You know, before we get into it, I do have to just make a small comment. I want to, you know, jump into our topic today about how do you turn patients into an evangelist, which I think is a big topic that every private practice physician should know, private practice or not. But I have to kind of give a little shout out, seeing that, you know, I come from the world of science and medicine. You by far have the best tagline on your website. And I'm going to read it here. If you go to physiciansguidetodoctoring.com, it's Dr. Bradley Block. And right under it is, this podcast answers the question, what should we have been learning while we were memorizing Krebs cycle? I gotta give a slow clap for that one.
Thank you for saying what we've all been thinking. Right, and actually, one of the things that I learned from my podcast is I interviewed an evolutionary biologist. Okay, don't worry, this is not a non sequitur. We'll get there. So I interviewed an evolutionary biologist, and the point of his book, his name is Nathan Lentz. Is that we're a mess. Human beings are a mess, but we're a beautiful mess. We have like a lot of these kind of nonsensical mutations and things that we have that just don't make sense. And the reason is because evolution builds on things that are already there. Like one of the examples was vitamin C. We can't produce our own vitamin C. And most I think mammals are able to. And it's just because we were living in a place where it was constantly in our diets, and a couple mutations later, we can't produce it anymore. So, you know, these things just happen. And or like the wrist. If you were going to build a wrist from scratch, you would not build it with 11 different bones, like rocks all stuck together. It would work very differently if you built it from scratch. But these things aren't built from scratch. They're built on top of something that already existed. And that includes medical education. Medical education is built on what it once was. And then the next iteration is going to be built on what it is now. And so, you know, just like it's really hard for evolution to get rid of a structure, it's really hard for medical education or any institution to get rid of something. And so we keep these parts of our education because that's the way it's always been done, which, as far as I'm concerned, is the worst reason to do anything. And so we learn a lot of things that aren't useful. Like, you are an expert in persuasion, right? If we had a class on persuasion instead of memorizing where malleate and fumarate are in the Krebs cycle, right, it would be so much more beneficial, because we'd be able to use those tools to help our patients to better help themselves. But we're not. We're not taught persuasion. Why not?
I completely agree. No, I completely agree. And, you know, for me, when I was in medical school, it was like 2009, 2010. So things, you know, the school I went to, they'd had more, they got rid of a lot of basic science and said, you know, let's focus more on clinical stuff. But even so, even today, there's, you know, I have friends who are entering medical school and they're trying to train them to be able to go toe to toe with the PhDs and like biochemistry. I'm like, what's the point? Like, they're, you know, like, medicine and especially patient care is getting so much more complicated. I mean, just adding the internet by itself, right? And how that influences patients is a huge thing. And so teaching physicians persuasion, you know, managing a brand on social media, how do you influence and educate the population as a whole? Like, look what happened with COVID, right?
Oh, yeah.
You know, so people think that we live in a world where people follow the science. The thing with science is that when it's left alone to do its like science thing behind closed doors and across labs, it works. But the moment it starts being brought into the public eye, it's not about science anymore. It's really about like what team you're on and what does that team believe. And then that's the science that you follow.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And then there's the whole science communication, right? There are effective ways. There are tried and true and tested ways of communicating science. And that's what we do every day in the office, right? When we're talking to our patients, we're communicating science. So to be trained in science communication, one, to the individual, and two, to the public, I think is critical and really important, because, you know, patients hear things like, well, you know, the vaccine only lasts for 6 months. No, it lasts at least 6 months. That's what we know. It could last forever. Now, I don't think it will, but that's very different from it lasts only 6 months. So what we say versus what we hear can be very different things. And so to be aware of that in your communication style, I think is really important and should be part of the curriculum. And that's going to have to bump stuff out. Like you said, we're not going to have to go toe-to-toe with a PhD in biochemistry unless that's our chosen path, in which case you're going to learn it later, right? So yeah, I think there's a lot of stuff. And the case in point is the Krebs cycle, because that's just everyone's pain point. Everyone's pain point. It's just useless memorization. We're never ever going to know.
It's so true. Well, real quick, you know, just for a lot of our audience who's just getting introduced to you, what's kind of like your origin story before we jump into today's topic? Like, where'd you grow up? How'd you choose medicine as a path? You know, and where'd you train? And how'd you end up to where you are today?
So I grew up, I guess, middle class, upper middle class Jewish kid on Long Island. So, you know, I didn't have many role models in medicine, not many people to look up to in terms of, you know, other. I'm just kidding. You know, it's such an on-brand thing to do for me to become a doctor, right? Although that wasn't the original choice, it kind of evolved. I didn't make the decision till later on in college. And actually, when I did make that decision, my parents said, you know, you're going to have to talk to people if you're a doctor, right? So like interpersonal skills were not really my strong suit. Now, compared to the average person, I think they're not really my strong suit. And given that my audience is primarily physicians, I shouldn't be insulting physicians, but we know, you know, this is not one of our, we're not really known for being the most dynamic people around. Sometimes we are, and often we're not. So I think the bar is a little different if you're comparing me to the general population versus the physician population, but nonetheless, it's something that I never saw as my strong suit. And so flash forward many years through my training, here I am in private practice, and we're supposed to be, you know, flying through patients. Like, there's no admin day for grand rounds and teaching medical students and prepare and writing my research. Like, I'm just seeing patients all the time. And even though I'm a surgeon in residency, we spend most of the time in the operating room and a little time in the office. In private practice, we spend most of the time in the office. and some of the time. So I'm seeing tons of patients, right? And I need to do it efficiently. And I need to be able to connect with them, get them to trust me, find out what's wrong with them, evaluate them, make a decision for what I think is wrong with them, decide what the next steps are going to be, make sure they're on board with that, and make sure they are understanding all that. And then on to the next one for like 30, 25. I mean, COVID, it's, you know, slowed down. I'm like 25 patients a day, but like, you know, 30, some people see 40 patients a day. Some people see more than that. So to be able to do all that, and then on to the next one, on to the next one, on to the next one, I was struggling. I was finding it challenging. Struggling is kind of strong, but I was finding it challenging. And then I met my wife, who her strong suit is interpersonal relations. Like, she'll go to a cocktail party and float around the room, and everybody at the end of the night thinks that they're her best friend, right? That's just how she is. She knows how to make people feel special, help people feel heard. And I like to just stand on the wall with a scowl on my face and a drink in my hand so I don't have to talk to anybody, right? And the reason that is because I'm not good at it. You know, she's great at it. So it reinforces itself. Okay, so where am I going with this? How am I going to get the podcast? Well, so I spent a lot of time when I first moved to New York. I actually lived in Manhattan and would commute out to Long Island, which is where my office is, and it would be a lot of driving. And so having just come out of residency where we had no free time, I'm like, I'm just going to sit in the car listening to music for like an hour and a half every day. This seems insane, an absurd waste of time. What am I going to do? I'm going to learn something. So I started listening to podcasts. And as it turns out, there are people like you out there with certain skill sets and certain knowledge base teaching people how to interact with other people, right? Like, but it wasn't being taught to doctors. It was like dating and like for executives and for sales. But these skill sets translate to the exam room. So since there was no podcast out there, I decided to make one. So thus was born The Physician's Guide to Doctoring. However, it didn't start out in these soft skill sets, because you can't just like call up strangers and be like, I don't have a podcast, but I want to start one. So can I interview you? So I had to start with my network. And my network, you know, having gone to medical school and, you know, college, and everyone, if you're a physician listening to this, you have the same network. You have a network of experts. The people that you've surrounded yourself your whole life have all turned into experts in various things. And so I turned that network into the first few episodes. So, you know, I have a friend who's the head of patient experience for a major hospital in upstate New York. I had him on. Someone who develops 3D printing technology for biotechnology. So I interviewed him on medical device, you know, pitching your idea to industry. My brother has a PhD in health policy economics. He wrote some of Obamacare. So I had him teaching us about health policy. So you have your network of experts. So I started with that. And then you get enough episodes, you can start calling up strangers. And then I took it to the, more of the soft skills, which has always been my passion. And that's what I'm focusing on more now. I still do the other things, you know, as stuff comes up, I'll focus on other topics, because I'm kind of like a, you know, Swiss Army knife for physicians. I try to cover everything that's relevant to the practicing physician. But my passion, a lot of my focus tends to be those soft skills.
Got it. And currently what kind of practicing physician are you? What's your specialty?
Oh, right. I just like leapfrogged through time from like,
you missed all the good parts that every physician wants to know. Yeah. Like, where'd you train? What are you practicing? And now what's your specialty interests?
Yeah. Okay. So I trained at Georgetown in otolaryngology. So ear, nose, and throat. And then right out of residency, I was hired by a private practice on Long Island, which is where I grew up. I never thought, you know, I left in college and thought I'd never be coming back. But here I am, practicing spitting distance from the mall. But, you know, that's life. Hired by ENT and Allergy Associates, where I'm now a partner, which happens to be the biggest ENT practice in the country. We're actually, I think, five times bigger than the second biggest ENT practice in the country.
Wow.
We're a monster practice, and I'm drinking the Kool-Aid.
How many ENTs are there?
So I think we're somewhere around 220 physicians.
Wow. That's a big,
And every office has one allergist. So it's allergists and ENTs.
Wow. That's definitely big. And how many locations do you guys have?
Around 40.
Wow.
A little over 40.
Wow.
Yeah. And we're in the New York metro area. So we're like way out in Jersey, we're not quite to Albany in New York, but we're pretty high up there, Fishkill. And then we're all the way out to the Hamptons and all five boroughs. So we're, our footprint's pretty big.
Well, I'm going to put it out.
And physician owned.
Yeah.
We're owned. Like, I'm a partner. So I am.
That's what we want to see more of. I mean, for the most part, I mean, for Gentem, that's really what we went into business. We were founded by a physician. Our whole thing is helping physicians to like stay independent in private practice. So we love hearing that story. I'm just going to say it right now, because I know, there's going to be certain people in the audience who are going to literally either text me or email me to ask you back on this. But I know we're going to have you back on just to talk about the pathway in terms of how do you become a partner as a physician, because there's all kinds of things legally and contractually and persuasion wise that you need to do, right?
No.
And you grimaced.
No. Well, the reason I grimaced is because like I'm one of 160 partners. And like my role in the, so the way my practice works, and I really don't want to talk about it extensively because it's as much as it's my practice, it's not my practice. Like I didn't found this practice. I didn't build this practice. I just happened to walk into a great situation.
Got it.
We're governed by a physician, elected physician board.
Got it.
But we also have committees. And so my time in the practice, you can be on a committee if you're interested in something. So we have all sorts of committees. Like for instance, I was the chair of the audiology committee, which interfaces with the head of audiology, who's like sits in or near the C-suite to help manage that part of the practice. I was also on compliance, where reviewing people's charts to make sure they're billing and coding and practicing appropriately. Although recently I founded my idea, the patient experience committee. So we're really in our infancy now, because that's where what my passion is, right? Like, and that's what I'm learning about. One of the advantages of being a podcaster is I've gotten a whole bunch of people on the show recently who run patient experience for like huge hospital systems. So like, if I want to ask them questions, I'm like, hey, I've got a podcast.
That's perfect. And you get free. It's free. It's like free consulting, right? But
free consulting.
Good.
Exactly.
Good
exactly.
segue. So, for every physician, whether you're in a large practice or you're like a solo practitioner, not only having happy patients, but turning them into evangelists, right, for your practice, for you, is one of the most important things, right? My father was a general surgeon for 35 years, and I'll never forget, like, we lived in a rather large city. When I would go around and somebody would literally go out of their way to in a mall or something to come and tell me, hey, your father took care of my mother or saved my life or did this. Even now, sometimes, like random patients will somehow find me on LinkedIn and they'll leave a comment on one of my posts just saying something that my father did for them, right? So in these days with so much complexities with social media and everything, it's even more important to have evangelists as patients. So where do you start? Take us through that.
So, at this point I've been practicing for 10 years and just to take you to the finish line, I've gotten to the point where marketing for me is kind of self-fulfilling. The patients now market for me, and they do it on Facebook groups. So like all these different towns around my area, if someone writes, I need an ear, nose, and throat doctor, I have a bunch of patients that they've had such good experiences with me that they do the marketing, right? They're like, you have to go see Dr. Black. You have to go see. And it's not like just me, right? Like in my own town, I barely see my name. My name doesn't come up. It's someone else, because I don't live that close to my office. And also the density in the New York area, there's a lot of doctors around, but it doesn't, I don't need it to come up in my town because there are enough in these other towns that are around my office. So the question is, how do you turn those patients into these marketing machines? How do you turn these patients into evangelists? who refer their family. Like, one of the advantages of ENT, people don't realize this, is like, I see three generations of the same family. Often, like, patient will come in, bring their kid, bring their parent, and like, you know, so how do you get there? How do you get there? Right. And because the patient experience is so important to me, because physician-patient communication is so important to me, I think that's how I got there. It's not that I do the best septoplasty of anyone around, or I take tonsils out the best, I take earwax out the best. No, it's not that. I mean, I do, right? But I'm the best sinus surgeon. I'm the best sleep surgeon. It's because the patient leaves feeling, or at least I try, okay? I don't always do it. I don't always get great reviews. I get some terrible reviews. But my intention is for every patient to leave seen, heard, and understood. And if you, even if you can't fix their problem, as long as they feel validated, they feel seen, they feel cared about, then this is, you know, that's how you turn them into an evangelist. So then the question is, how do you get there? Right. And it starts with the introduction. A lot of this stuff I'm taking from my previous guests. So one of it starts with the introduction. And this I got from actually, their name is Crystal Beal. Their website is queerdoc.com, right? They take care of, you know, non-binary patients and the LGBTQ community online. And one thing that I learned from them is the introduction, right? I mean, most patients refer to themselves as the pronoun you would expect for them. But for those who don't, right, the minute you start if you start the visit wrong, mm-hmm. they're lost, right? If you start the visit right, it puts you heads and tails above everyone else. And so the introduction that we came up with, or actually that they came up with, works for everybody. Introduce yourself. Hi, my name is Brad Block. You can call me Brad. You can call me Dr. Block. What would you like me to call you? That works for everybody.
I like that.
Because it's so awkward. Like, do I call you Omar? Do I call you Mr. Khatib? Do you like your initials? Do you like being called OK? Like, I don't know. Like, that might be what your friends call you. But if I don't ask that question, then I don't call you anything.
Yeah.
Right. So start it off with what you want to be called. And it can be Dr. So-and-so, right? It can be Dr. Block. I still am not used to that, you know. Been a doctor for 15 years. I'm still used to that. But I'm Dr. Block. I'm Dr. Brad Block. And you always have to introduce yourself, because here's another point. They may not have made their appointment. Someone else may not have made their appointment. Someone else may have made their appointment. So you need to introduce yourself. Don't just walk in the room and assume they know who you are. Hi, I'm Dr. Brad Block. And you can't leave the doctor out of it. You have to assume that they wouldn't know that you're a doctor. So you got to say it. Hi, I'm Dr. Brad Block. You can call me Brad. Dr. Block, how would you like me to refer to you? And then, you know, and then you can say something like, who else is in the room with you? Because sometimes there's a multi-generational family. Sometimes they appear older than stated age. And so the person that you thought was their spouse is actually their child, or vice versa, right? You could sometimes get this stuff wrong. So make sure you don't get that stuff wrong, you know. So how would you like me to refer to you, and who else is with you? And that works for everyone.
That's fantastic. And it makes so much sense why that works, because you're essentially not introducing any bias in that question, and you're not coming up with any assumptions. You're allowing the patient to literally give you information, and from there you can go to the next step, versus a lot of times, whether it's physicians or even salespeople, you come in with your own biases and preconceived notions, and then you make a big mistake, and then, you know, the whole experience is ruined. So after you do that kind of introduction, what's next? Like, you know, when you do that introduction, I know now with COVID things are a little bit different, but do you usually shake hands? Do you, you know, how do you proceed, you know, after that?
Yeah. I used to shake hands, even though in ear, nose, and throat, it's a terrible idea, right? We see upper respiratory tract infections all the time. And so that's something that I never want to come back to again. I even put a sign on my wall. Leave your mask on until we ask you to take it off, and shaking hands for your protection is no longer a thing, or whatever the sign happens to say. So I sit down, you know, how would you like me to refer to you? And then I sit down. So what brings you here today? Right? Like and you can say whatever you want. I don't think that it needs to be that, you know, whatever your style is. Why are you here? What's your chief complaint? What brings you here today? What's, you know, whatever, whatever your open-ended question is that allows them to, get started. And here is where I actually disagree with what's commonly taught. Interrupting is okay. You have to be judicious about it. You have to be mindful about it. But, you know, all these studies say that doctors interrupt patients within the first. Yeah, you know what? You have to be mindful of the people in the waiting room. You can't just let, we're not lawyers where you bill by the hour. I would love to just be like, what brings you here today? Click the clock. I'm on your time. Go ahead. Talk for as long as you want. But that's not realistic. That's not realistic. What's realistic is people think in terms of urgency, and we need to hear things in terms of chronological order. So I think it's really important to remind people of that. You don't need to say to them like that, but like, you know, from the beginning, you could be like, listen, it would be really helpful if you could tell me what happened in chronological order. Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. Instead of like, yeah, the other night I my head really hurt. Because, you know, 5 days before that, you know, I had banged my head on the stove, like bending over to pick something up. And then, you know, but, you know, that reminds me, like a couple weeks before I was kind of dizzy and maybe that's related. And I'm not, you know, and they're like all over the map. And you're like, okay. I'm sorry. Because what you're doing is you're helping them to clarify their own story in their head. And at the end, you're going to repeat it back to them. But I think interrupting, like the doctors interrupt too much. I think interrupting is fine as long as you're doing it, you know, in a way that helps them to be heard and to be understood. Not like, I don't want to hear that, you know, or, you know, you got to do it in a specific way for a specific reason.
And it makes sense because people are coming to you, I mean, as an expert and it's consultative, right? So there has to be some sort of guidance. I feel like, you know, a few decades ago or, you know, prior to 2000, whenever it happened, like maybe there was a lot of arrogance and a little bit too, you know, not enough like good bedside manners in medicine, but then it just swung into the other direction where, you know, there are physicians who are literally like, in my opinion, they're not physicians. Like I went to a doctor, I'll never forget it, many years ago. And I was going into, you know, for an issue I was having, and the doctor told me like, you know, here's what we think it is. You can do this or this. And so I asked the doctor, I'm like, what should I do? Well, you can do this or this. I'm like, I'm not making myself clear. You're the physician. I'm the patient. Tell me what to do. I'm paying you for that. I literally had to tell this doctor. And the guy was like, look, you know, you can do this. Here's the pros and cons. I'm like, and I just threw my hands up. I was like, are you kidding me? You know, so there has to be like a middle in the road, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, but, you know, people are looking for guidance, but they're not looking for you to make
right.
the decision for them. They're just looking you to, you know, kind of shepherd them in one
exactly.
direction or another. And, but sometimes the answer is not clear, right? Like if I have someone who comes in with a nasal fracture and it's like really minimal, it's really like you can barely see it. Like, do I do a procedure on them that's going to be really painful for something that's barely going to help them? Well, it depends on the person, right? Some people are like, oh man, this looks terrible. Yeah. Oh, that doesn't sound like a big deal. Yeah, totally. Or someone's like, you're going to do what for this? No way. So like it really, some of that ultimately does depend on the patient, but it's important to deliver it in a way that helps them to make that decision or even validates their experience, right? Like you were saying, like, listen, what I tell them is in that situation, sometimes these decisions are the hardest to make. If your nose was on the other side of your face, the decision to do something would be super easy. It's obvious. But like, you're going to spend a lot of time deliberating over what the right thing to do is because it's not so clear. But to put things in perspective, the reason it's not so clear is because either way, it's the right decision. And both ways, it's not a big deal. So like, you know, informing them that both of these are still the right answer, it just, and neither of them is going to change things that much. But just to like leave them, be like, yeah, do whatever you want to do. That's not the same thing.
So in your encounter, you know, what are some common sort of pitfalls you feel that physicians often do, you know, if it's not guiding the interaction well, and the patient ends up wasting a lot of time, and you end up getting backed up in the waiting room. What are some other, I feel like there's some common pitfalls that happen all the time that if you just take care of those, it'll provide a much better patient experience.
So one thing is, it's sometimes necessary to set an agenda. And I got this from Jonathan Winkle. He's a med ped specialist in the Pittsburgh area. And he wrote, I can't remember the name of his book offhand, but so what he says is he's a primary care physician. So often when people come to see me, they've got one, maybe two things, right? Like you've been having nosebleeds and you're dizzy. But with him, it's like, you know, their blood pressure and their diabetes and their depression and their, right? So, and they've got what they want to take care of. And then he's got his agenda. So what he'll do is he'll set an agenda at the beginning. And either they get to pick two things and he gets to pick one, or he gets to pick two things and they get to pick one. But from the get-go, right, this is how you set an agenda and say, these are the things that we actually have time for today that we can do well. And then if you want to deal with these other things, and we'll take your priorities into consideration, right? There's what you want to treat and what I want to treat. So I think setting an agenda is important. A lot of times, there is what I call the question behind the question, which is the patient comes in telling you that this is their complaint, but what they're worried, what they're really worried about, they haven't verbalized. And I think it's really important. And sometimes this comes across with the patients that are like, no, you're not hearing me. No, you're not understanding me. Your headache, it sounds really bad, but it's not your sinuses. Like, get more antibiotics isn't going to do anything for, like, what is it they're really worried about? And I think it's important for them to verbalize that during the visit. And if they don't, they're going to leave pretty unfulfilled. And the visit might be more time consuming than it otherwise would be. So one way to get it out is there anything about this that worries you? Is there anything about this that worries you? Or what about this worries you? Something like that. An example for me is people come in with globus. Globus is a feeling of something stuck in your throat. And a lot of times we don't find, in fact, the old name for it is called globus hystericus, right? Because that doctor in the 1950s that, you know, smoking a cigarette in the room, puts out his cigarette and is going to shake you by the shoulders and say, stop being hysterical. There's nothing there. So it's called globus hystericus, right? The patient's being hysterical. Now, we don't call it that. We call it globus pharyngeus, but nonetheless, it is a feeling of something in your throat, a glob, a globus, when there's nothing actually down there. And a lot of times these patients are worried that they have throat cancer. And so unless you tell them explicitly, you don't have throat cancer, they're going to leave worried that one, you didn't evaluate them for it, and two, you may have missed it. But if you say, what about this? And I've gotten away from saying, just verbalizing it, because I've seen so many patients with the same complaint, and I've changed it, because sometimes I'll say, it's not throat cancer. And they're like, oh, wow, I never even thought of that. And now you've put it out there in the universe. But it's important to ask the question if they're like, you know what, I was really worried that this could be cancer. Cancer. Right? They're sometimes they don't even want to say it out loud. They're going to whisper it. And so now you've said, actually, I've evaluated you for it. I looked all the way down your throat, looked at your whole voice box. I don't see anything. And when it does tend to happen, it tends to grow on the surface. And so I would be able to see it if it was there. And what I see you for, what I've seen you for, and actually this, what I'm about to say, I actually got from Scott Abramson, another guest of mine, a neurologist out, he just retired out in Northern California. He says, you know, my Aunt Sally had something like that. When it happened to her, okay, I can't imitate his accent so well. But he'll like say a family member that had something similar. You know, my cousin had the same lump sensation. So I sent him to see one of my partners. And what happened was, I looked down his throat, didn't find anything. And just the fact that it was on his mind so much, the fact that someone looked at him and said that nothing was there, that alone made it evaporate, because there was this we think there was this feedback loop between the sensation and his worry, and the sensation and his worry, and it kept on feeding on itself, and it went away. This is like the power of an anecdote. So one, you know, there's kind of two points here. One is the verbalizing what they're really worried about, and two is the power of an anecdote. Instead of, like, I see this all the time, or 99% of people with this get better, saying something like, you know, I had a family member with something similar to this, and you know, this is what happened to them. So these, you know, you're humanizing it, and now suddenly, this person that if you hadn't verbalized it, they would have left still worried that they had throat cancer. Now they're like, oh man, oh that doctor, and in the doctor's eyes, did I do anything for that person? Did I cure their cancer? Did I do some ridiculous, you know, complicated surgery on them? Was I the person that invented the chemotherapy or discovered the chemotherapy that cured their cancer? No. But they leave there feeling like this doctor gets them, this doctor understands them, and oh my goodness, that doctor really made me feel so much better. So in my eyes, I actually didn't do that much. I didn't. You know, compared to what some of my colleagues are doing in the academic medical centers with the commando surgeries and a laryngectomy and bilateral neck dissections and forearm free flaps. I'm not doing that stuff. I did that stuff in residency. I'm not doing that stuff in practice. But my patients, they leave feeling this way because if you take a methodical approach to it, then, you know, they leave with a much better experience.
The more, you know, the more I listen, it makes complete sense, which is, you know, the patient vision cannot be without boundaries, and the patient can't just like go in any direction they want, because at the end of the day, you only have so much time to help them. And in that case, they're not following a certain procedure guideline for you to actually help with a diagnosis and potentially treatment. So it seems like the key is really setting, you know, good guidelines and guiding the patient to get the right information out of them. But along the way doing it, using certain approaches and heuristics to make them feel comfortable, to make them feel heard. And more importantly, you know, I think, and this happens like with experience, to understand that, like, you know, they're coming in for this thing, but underneath that, there's this other problem. And let's find a way to kind of eliminate both of them so that when they leave, they're leaving feeling better, even though you didn't do anything. Right. And I think, you know, exactly. This is like the one study or multiple studies that's always referenced in medical school, is that like psychiatrists, I don't know if this is still true or not, psychiatrists are the ones who are not sued as often because, you know, they spend the most time talking to their patients. Right. You know, and I think the bigger part of that is, you know, when at the end of the day, I think people, they, if they have a problem, especially something as personal and sensitive as their health, that they want to go talk to somebody and just get some resolution, some clarity, right? Because it's this big unknown and there's all these fears like of what it could be, what it can't be. And if they have that kind of experience, like I think it's one of those things where it's simple, but it's not easy to do it this way, right? Because it takes discipline.
Yeah. Yeah, it takes practice and it takes effort. Yeah. Like I view it as like, maybe not a boxing match, but more like
those are two amazingly different things. I love that you would start with boxing match. But yeah.
Well, but there are some similarities, right? Like your partner in it, like I feel like sometimes I'm bobbing and weaving, trying to manage the communication. I mean, just the communication.
You have to lead, right? In some ways
on my part. And to be fair, exactly. But sometimes I just don't have it in me. Right. And so like a lot of times I can see my one star Google reviews were nights. And, you know, when we spoke earlier, you could hear the screaming in the background. You know, I've got my oldest just turned 5. So I've got 3 boys that are a little over 3 years apart between the 3 of them. And so I sometimes don't get a lot of sleep, and I'm now in my 40s. So I don't have what I used to have in residency to go on so little sleep. And so like, I just don't always have it in me to do that. And that's sometimes when I get those negative reviews. And, you know, I think it's important to take those negative reviews and not just dismiss them. Like, I think a lot, sometimes it's about the copay or something that's completely out of, or the front desk, something's out of your control. Although the front desk could be in your control. And yeah. I do want to talk about that a little bit. But there's sometimes something to be learned, and you know, I'm human too. So don't think that like every visit of mine is like the Zen master of no. I'm a work in progress.
Yeah. Let's talk about that. Cause our good friend, Dr. Brent Lacy, I was talking to him the other day, and he made an interesting point about this, which was,
yeah,
you know, to really look at the whole experience, like go out, like take your coat off. And if people don't know you, that, you know, even better, but try going out and just sitting in your waiting room and kind of seeing like, what is it like? Like, is it too loud? Does it smell weird? Are the magazines crappy? Like what, you know, but let's go outside. Cause I think Persuasion, I have Robert Cialdini's latest book up there, which is what can you do ahead of the point of persuasion and influence, which we can call, let's say, the patient encounter. So in the waiting room and the front desk experience, what kind of things can you do to sort of improve and optimize the chances that you turn these patients into evangelists?
First of all, that book should be mandatory reading. Like, he should be teaching classes in medical school, right? The Godfather of Persuasion should definitely be teaching us, because that's so important to what we do, right? Because if you can't convince someone and because right to your point before, yeah, I mean, that you can't be so wishy-washy, be like, yeah, it could be this, it could be that. But I think it's our role, because this is what we do. If we know, fine, it's their body. So there are some things that they understand better than we do. But there are things that we understand. And so it's important to kind of shepherd them in the right direction. And that takes persuasion. So again, I'm preaching to the choir here. Okay. So with regards to the patient experience, one of the things that they say in the whole customer experience world is that there are internal customers and external customers, right? Your internal customers are your staff, and your external customers are your patients. So if your internal customers are not satisfied, then your external customers are not going to be satisfied. And so how do you make your internal customers satisfied? How do you make your internal customers evangelists? It's not that complicated. It's not that complicated. You need to care. You need to care about them. You need to care about them as people outside of the office. You need to know who their spouse is. You need to know who their children are. You need to know who they live with. You need to know about them. So every so often, you need to go out to the front desk and not necessarily to the waiting room to check out the magazines, which is certainly important, but to check on the staff, to make sure that they're okay. Sit down and find out, how are they doing? The other reason that's important to talk to them is because they know where the pain points are, and they're going to have ideas for how to fix them. So there need to be ways for you to get their ideas to fruition. Fine, they're going to have terrible ideas, just like you're going to have terrible ideas. But they're going to have some great ideas, and they're going to be able to tell you how to make your practice better. So they need to be seen, and they need to be heard, just like your patients do. And so I think it's important to every so often go out there and just take the time to find out how they are. And they love lunch. Fine. Buy them lunch. Buy them Starbucks. You know, throw in more, increase their wages. People love that. But the simplest and the cheapest thing to do is to genuinely care about them, find out how they're doing, and know who they are. Because if you don't know who their significant other is, if you don't know what their kids' names are, like, they're your staff. You're with them every day.
No, I completely agree. And I think, like, at least some of the valuable things I learned from the business world, I'm doing that as we speak with one of my first hires on our marketing team, which is to, you know, not only understand who they are, like, outside of work, you know, their personal interests and everything, but to also look into, you know, their professional interests and try and align those interests with goals of the organization. So I, at least from when I speak to certain physicians, I advise them, like, when it comes to their staff and when it comes to marketing, you know, I guarantee you within any office, even if it's an office of like two or three staff members, one of them is going to be really into Instagram. And so see if that person's going to be interested to help you with Instagram and like reward them for it. Like, you know, I think that's like one of the best things to do is to figure out like who people are, you know, as people outside of work, what are they interested in? And how do you sort of align those things, you know, with the needs of the organization. Some people, like in my father's office, you know, his office manager was sort of a motherly, you know, figure. And so he entrusted her to do a lot of things, like, you know, for the staff, for like, you know, like team lunches and organizational things and everything. Yeah. Team building stuff.
Yeah. Team building stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Very
like the
much.
Mother,
very
the mother, the mother hen. Yeah. Absolutely.
Play to people's strengths
and it's going to make them feel more valued. You get to capitalize on their strengths. It's and they're going to enjoy it because people like doing things they're good at.
Aside from going out and, you know, like just generally checking on the staff, seeing how they're doing everything, is there something that you recommend doing, whether it's on a weekly or monthly basis? Like, how do you start developing that kind of cadence and culture of like, hey, I want to hear your ideas. We're not going to do all of it, but like, let's try certain things. And then how do you start rewarding the behaviors that way this becomes like part of the culture of the office?
That's an excellent question, and I'm going to have to get back to you on it because we just started the patient experience committee, and we've had like one meeting so far. So, you know, I've been doing some of these things within my own office, but as far as bringing it to the larger organization, that's going to be, especially with an organization the size of mine, right? We have like over 1,000 employees. That's going to be more of a challenge. How do you get ideas from, you know, someone who's at the front desk all the way to the C-suite so that it, you know, works its way throughout the entire company in all 40 yes. offices? How do you, is that what, that's what you're asking? Okay. I don't know. but I think that's, to me, that's one of the goals of the committee. Like, that's why I created the committee, so that we would be that conduit that brings those ideas. And what we've been doing so far is you beta test them. You test them in an office, test them in two offices, test them in five offices before it becomes something that every office has to do. See which offices want to do it and see if it flies with them. Work out the kinks. And then once you've worked it out in a smaller setting, then you can read. So if you've got someone with that idea, be like, great, execute it, do it, make it happen. Right in this office, we'll see how it goes. We'll see how it flies. Worst thing is, we say, you know what, it didn't work out. But I think you take that
Absolutely.
Person and take that
now,
enthusiasm.
You know,
and put them
I want to be
work.
Mindful of your time, but just, you know, the last thing I wanted to, or a couple of things I wanted to touch on. So we got sort of a nice framework as to how to bring the patient, how to start the encounter, how to guide it, right? How to address underlying concerns, like the question behind the question. What about wrapping it up and ending the patient encounter and sending them off? Like, are there any specific tips there? Are there some things that physicians get wrong often that they can fix?
So one thing is, I think the way a question, this particular question is framed is important. And it's, am I being clear? Like, you put the onus on you when you're asking that question, because you never want, you want the patient to feel comfortable saying, no, actually, you're not being clear at all. That was super confusing. But if you say, are you understanding me? Then the question is, you know, are they having a problem understanding? Not am I have a problem, problem articulating? Are you having a problem? So I think when you're asking that question at the end of the visit, I think the way you frame is important. Am I being clear? So, And then how do you wrap it up? I mean, the way I do it, and I have Dragon, so I dictate my visits, is at the end of the visit, and I don't do this every time, I should do this every time, is at the end of the visit, I dictate a summary of the visit. You know, so this is what we believe is going on. These are the next steps that we're taking. We're putting you on antibiotics. We're getting a CAT scan. You know, we talked briefly about surgery. If we decide to do it, we're going to speak about it again next time. Some information about the surgery has been included. And then, you know, what happens is that prints out. So then when they check out, make their follow-up appointment, they get a printout that includes what I just dictated. So then they hear a summary of the visit. They get a printout that includes the summary of the visit and anything else that I want them to read. And then they promptly throw that in the garbage. Let's be realistic. That's what happens to this paperwork most of the time. But for some of them, at least it's available to them. And the other thing is, you know, we have a patient portal. It goes on the patient portal. They can access it online if they've signed up for the patient portal. And so I think it's important for efficiency, because charting is important for billing. Like with the new coding system, what you dictate at the conclusion of the visit is going to determine what you can bill for that visit, because it's all about medical decision making. So the more you can review that, understand it, and include that in your summary, the more you can use it to bill appropriately. We're not talking about overcoding. We're talking about coding appropriately and getting paid what you should be paid for the complexity of the visit. So it's important for that reason, for billing. But it's important also because then the patient hears what you said and then has the opportunity to review it in print if they so choose. So there's no, I don't have any like fancy guru advice there. That just happens to be what
I do. That makes complete sense. And I think that, you know, I can assure you that my young marketing manager is going to love this interview because you actually shared like a fantastic framework that we'll probably love writing up. Now, before we let you go, and again, it's late over there on the East Coast, so we do appreciate you coming on, like putting your kids to bed and jumping on to do a podcast this late at night. But, you know, this sort of end of our podcast, we do this kind of fun thing, a little rapid fire question. So I'm going to ask you some questions. You can take as long or as short as you'd like to answer. The faster you answer, the faster I'll get to the next question. Okay. All right. So here we go. So first question.
All right. That,
you know, medicine has a culture of mentorship. Right. And so we've had great mentors, teachers along the way, but through your life and residency, and even now, what was something that somebody told you that was extremely painful for you to hear, but it changed you for the better?
So I played rugby in college for 2 years. And at the end of the second year, the coach, who was, you know, just some guy in the community, that he, you know, like owned a gas station, but he loved rugby. So he coached this college rugby team. He's pretty drunk, pulls me aside. He's like, "You're not fast. You're not tough. You're not big. You don't have a lot of heart." Just kind of like, and that was like the end of the talk. That was the whole thing. It was like, "You suck." And I was like, "Why am I playing rugby?" Like, I'm really not enjoying. I like the idea of like thinking I'm tough, but I'm really not that tough. So like that was the end of rugby season for me. So that was it was not easy to hear. I can't even remember if he said something positive. He may have. He probably did. But mostly it was you really don't have anything to offer this team. And
That's an interesting one. Why did that one come to mind?
It was painful to hear. It's painful to hear how much you suck. Like, just no filter, just straight up, you suck. Did it change me? Maybe that wasn't the best example because it didn't really change.
I'll give you a second shot. I'm keeping that one in because that's a hilarious story.
Painful.
Very sad. That's a tough one. But yeah, you want to stick with that one?
I'm trying to think of.
Let's say just something that was memorable that changed you.
I mean, this is a hell. This is a privilege. This is a privileged life I've led, huh?
What about something memorable that one of your mentors told you?
I can't remember.
Something that made you a better physician.
Painful to hear.
You're like all my mentors sucked.
No. You know, so there. Yeah, no, you do. You pick up these things along the way, and I remember the head of pediatric surgery at the Children's Hospital in Buffalo. Dr. Katie, I mean, this was 15 years ago. So who knows if he's still there? He said surgeons use two hands, and he wasn't referring to just in the operating room. At least I don't think. You know, it seemed like a Yoda-like thing to say. It's It's like surgeons use two hands. Whenever you have the opportunity to do something with two hands, you should do it with two hands. You should not do it with one hand. So this goes with like, I'm teaching my kids how to eat. And I'm like, use two hands. One hand holds the bowl. The other one holds the spoon. Use two hands. Whenever they're doing something, right? I'm encouraging them to use two hands because you can, if you have an opportunity to use two hands, whatever it is you're doing, you can probably do better. Now, if you're playing tennis and you have a one-handed backhand, that's a different story.
Makes a lot of sense. There is something Zen about that because it's kind of saying, you know, if you have the opportunity to metaphorically use two hands, you know, with things that even don't require hands, like you should take advantage of that. Don't be arrogant and not do that. That makes a lot of sense. I'm gonna have a kid next year, so I'm gonna remember that.
Yeah, surgeons just
use
two
hands. I'm gonna use that on my kid.
Do
Thanks.
It with one hand.
Thanks, Brad. I appreciate that. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's gonna be one of those things that they're gonna hate you for because they hear it over and over. It's like, ah, Dad. You know, I'm gonna be, you know, being a podcaster. You pick up a lot of this stuff, and you end up like, you know. It turns into your parenting mantras, and then they're like, oh, again.
You know what you need enough. To do with your boys though, when I they get older? Because my dad did this to me all the time. When I was like 14 years old, he did this. Someone would ask me some random surgical question or medical thing, and I wouldn't know. So I asked my dad, and my dad's response would be like, how do you not know this? You're the son of a surgeon. I'm like, I need to go to medical school. Why would I know this? He still does that with me sometimes.
Yeah. Although some people think the other way around. They're like,
aren't those people the worst?
I grew up with a surgeon.
Those people are
the
worst.
Significant other of a doctor.
Oh my God, they're terrible. You know what's strange? For some reason, that happens in medicine, which is, in my opinion, my humble opinion, one of the most complicated things you can learn about. Right, just in my opinion, it's the most difficult and like this. I don't think there's anything more difficult training wise in medical school. You see that in that. But I've never met someone who has a spouse who, you know, and the person is like, I don't know, in business or in law. And the spouse will say, oh, well, my wife is a lawyer or my wife is a marketer. You should, you know, and this is what you should do. I never hear that. But in medicine, which is way more complicated all the time. Like I'll be at a cocktail party and the guy's girlfriend was in residency and he was trying to tell somebody some advice about whether or not they should get some surgery. And I was listening, I'm like, this guy's an idiot. And the worst part was he was sober. The guy doesn't drink. So he had nothing to stand on. All right. We got two more questions. Next question is, you know, continuing education is a big thing in medicine. So we never stop learning. What's a book that you feel like you've gifted a lot to people or a podcast you've been recommending? I love it.
Mine.
It is a good podcast. I'm not going to lie.
Of course. You know, like a book that I've recommended to trainees. I mean, honestly, whenever I have, I'm in private practice. I don't really see a lot of trainees. When I do, they're pediatric residents from the hospital that are just looking to learn some more ear, nose, and throat stuff. So you know, I'm not giving them homework. I'm not, you know, they barely have any free time, so I'm not recommending books. But sometimes I'll tell them, you know, an episode or two of mine that I find applies to their particular.
It's helpful to do that, right?
And I've got like 130 episodes now, so.
Oh, go,
so
sorry, go ahead.
It's a lot, but yeah. But a book in general that I
by Viktor Frankl, fantastic.
Is Man's Search for Meaning.
So good.
It just ties into everything. It's so often that I see it, and especially with you know, the hardships that we see in medicine and the tragedies that we see and the tragedies that we live through. I think Man's Search for Meaning helps you get through it and find purpose and find, you know, find a path forward. And I think as physicians, we're so often where our patients are exposed to tragedy, helping them to find a path forward is
That's important.
That's probably one of the better recommendations I've heard in a long time. I don't know why. You're the first person to recommend it, but yeah. And actually, it makes so much sense, especially for those who are in training, to read that book and understand the meaning behind how your perceptions really do author your reality and how you can search for meaning and a path forward in your own suffering. Like it's, yeah. So in a very short book too. Yeah. All right. So last question for you. And again, we really appreciate you coming on so late. So let's imagine that for the next year that there's going to be a billboard that gets taken out and it's going to be in front of every single hospital, every major city, every physician is going to see this billboard every day they go into work. What do you put on that billboard?
You're better at this than you think. I don't know if in the billboard, maybe like a sticker on there. hang in there with the kitten hanging on. You know, maybe
that was
maybe
such a good,
billboard
that
for like
that was,
everyone
I
to
loved
see.
It.
But I think,
and then
I think
you,
that's
you
something.
Threw the kitten, the kitten, hang in there, baby. Yeah, the hang in there, baby kitten. Yeah, but I think that's there's a lot of wisdom in that message, though.
We're hard on ourselves. We're really hard on ourselves. Like we, and as human beings, and I've heard you talk about this on your podcast, you know, evolutionarily, we're designed to think a certain way, right? We are threat detection machines. We are just trying not to die. We are just trying to fit in with the herd, because if we're exiled from the herd or the tribe, then we're dead. And so, you know, if we do any little misstep, evolutionarily, it was a huge deal. And now it's not. Now it's actually the opposite. Like if you make some huge misstep, and like, you know, people like you're the victim of a Twitter pile on or something, like things move so quickly that like that's forgotten about in short order. Right. But we're still like, we think about it. So just the way that the human brain works, we're threat detection machines. And so when we do something wrong, or we could have done something better. Like that's what we take home with us, right? Not we're not remembering all of those patients that said how awesome we were and how much we changed their life and how much we helped them through something and how much that's not what we're taking home with us. And we really should. You're better at this than you think because you're taking this stuff home in order to improve. And there's something to that, right? But you know, you need to take some time to revel in the compliments and enjoy them and use those as well to help you get up the next day because you're better at this than you think you are. We're wired to not think
absolutely
that way, but you
I,
are
I
better
love that.
At this
and I think,
than you think you
I
are.
Think, you know, part of life is developing skills of the mind. And I think one of those skills is, you know, having a positive and confident outlook, and then also not caring about looking foolish, right? I think it's different for physicians because, you know, in some cases, like you might kill somebody, right? But I think it's very easy to be hard on yourself, but it's hard to kind of be easy on yourself. And just like, I'm glad you remind me of that. Cause like the other day, one of my, I can call him, I guess, a mentor from afar. And one of my favorite authors, Scott Adams, it was his birthday. So I tweeted at him. And I included some screenshots of his whiteboards, my favorite whiteboards he did from his like live show. And so he said, thank you, he retweeted that. And I'm looking at it right now, it was like 284,000 impressions, like retweeting all over the place. And then I reread the tweet and I was like, oh my God, I had a typo in there, which was when I said, I said, you know, instead of saying buy his, you know, to celebrate his birthday, buy his book. And I think my spell check changed the buy to butt. So like for his birthday, butt his books. And I was like, and I remember how bummed, I was almost going to delete it, but I was like, who cares? People know that I said buy. Who cares? No one's going to care. Whatever. You know? And I think like, I don't know. I think that was like one of the biggest things I learned to get better about after I left med school. Cause you just get so used to just whipping yourself into shape that you just have to take it easy and just believe in yourself, you know?
Yeah. And I know we're wrapping things up. I think that's important to communicate to your patients as well, right? For them to, because especially for patients that say struggle with their weight, right? Like they hear it all the time that, oh, you got to lose weight. You got to lose weight. How about instead of telling your patient to lose weight, how about tell your patient to give themselves a little grace? Give themselves a little room to just be okay. Not be so hard. Be okay where they are right now. At some point when they're ready, fine, work on it. But you're not telling them that it's okay and it's healthy to be at this size. That's not what you're telling them. You're telling them to just be a little nicer to themselves. Give themselves a little grace. And another thing that's going to turn them into your evangelist. They're going to leave you because every other doctor that they've seen is telling them, making them feel like an awful person, an awful specimen, an awful, right? But give themselves. So for us, we need to give ourselves a little grace. And it's helpful to communicate that to your patients, because you are in a position of authority. And when you say something like that to them, whether it's positive or negative, they're going to take it to heart and they're going to take it very seriously. So if you can make it something positive.
I love that. I can't think of a better way to kind of wrap things up. So Dr. Brad Block, thank you so much for coming on. I know you don't like to be called Dr. Block, but I got to do that. People can find you on your website, physiciansguidetodoctoring.com. I'm going to leave that in the show notes. And online, where can people find you?
So I'm on Twitter at Physicians Guide. I'm on LinkedIn at Bradley Block. I mean, you got to look me up. I'm sure there are a bunch of other Bradley Blocks. And on Instagram, where, you know, your mention of Instagram, find someone who loves Instagram. My wife loves Instagram. So maybe I need to give her the keys to my account so there can be some more. I don't get it. I don't get Instagram. So I'm barely on there, but at Physicians Guide on
I can't wait to see some Instagram reels of you doing some like lip syncing. It's just going to happen. So awesome. Well, thank you all for listening to the show. This is another episode of Journey to Private Practice. I'm your host, Omar M. Khatib, and we'll see you next time. That was great. Thanks for listening to this episode of Journey to Private Practice. If you like the show, hey, help other medical practice owners like yourself discover it. Please leave us a 5-star review, say a few nice things, and if anything, send this episode to somebody else, because I don't know about you, but for me, anytime anything good has happened in my life, it's been as a result of other people helping me. So forward this on, pay it forward, and we'll see you next time.